Welcome back to Interfaith Voices. I'm Amber Khan. As we've learned, since the Supreme Court's decision to legalize abortion 45 years ago, there have been a variety of cases attempting to either expand access to reproductive health care or restrict it. This week, we're discussing the latest of such cases, NIFLA v. Becerra. We get some help from Mary Ziegler, a law professor at Florida State University. Now, this case centered around a California law regulating crisis pregnancy centers. These are nonprofits often run by Christian groups that aim to counsel pregnant women and dissuade them from abortion.
Some of them specialize in things like free diapers and advice. Others also provide things like ultrasounds and pregnancy tests. So California had two laws. One of them applied to crisis pregnancy centers that were medically licensed, and the other applied to those that were not. So the medically licensed crisis pregnancy centers had to notify women about the availability of free or low-cost abortion and contraceptive services elsewhere, and that the state provided those at low cost or no cost. The unlicensed facilities had to provide a notice that they weren't licensed. So a group of crisis pregnancy centers sued, arguing that these laws violated the First Amendment's free speech clause. The arguments were varied, but one of them was essentially that California had discriminated on the basis of viewpoint and had favored those who thought that abortion was a valid health service and had discriminated against those who didn't feel that way and made them essentially parrot the message of the state.
The court ruled 5-4 that the California law requiring the notices violated the free speech of a coalition of centers that sued.
The majority would say California's kind of stepped on the toes of professionals with conscience-based objections for no reason, right? They could have done this in a less offensive way. For example, by, you know, having their own ad campaign about the availability of these services.
Justice Clarence Thomas wrote for the majority.
It's thought that content-based laws are presumptively unconstitutional. So Thomas said ostensibly that this speech is about a specific topic, abortion, and it's dictating what speakers have to say on that subject, so it's content-based.
And Thomas rejected California's argument that the speech of professionals, like those working at crisis centers, are less protected by the First Amendment.
Thomas turned to the rationale that the lower courts had used to uphold the law, which was that there's less scrutiny given to professional speech. And this has some kind of intuitive appeal, obviously. It would be weird if your doctor gave you irresponsible medical advice and committed medical malpractice and you couldn't sue because the doctor could cite the freedom of speech. So the lower courts had said that because at least some and potentially all crisis pregnancy center staff qualify as professionals, the state has more liberty to regulate or more power to regulate their speech than it would other speakers.
But Thomas and the majority rejected that argument, saying there was no category of professional speech in this case.
So the distinction that Thomas drew was that those laws primarily regulate conduct, that is the performance of an abortion procedure, rather than speech, here the posting of these notices, so those cases weren't applicable.
Ziegler explains the dissent written by Justice Stephen Breyer.
This case was about sort of privileging the speech or beliefs of those who have conscience-based objections to abortion over doctors who may have objections to reciting state-based scripts about abortion, because those laws the court has upheld. And Justice Breyer's dissent said there's really not a meaningful distinction between those laws and the one governing crisis pregnancy centers, other than the crisis pregnancy center regulation applies to people who oppose to abortion, and regulations of abortion doctors' speech apply to those who perform and support abortion rights. So I think both sides saw this as being a case about double standards and religious faith. It just depended on, you know, the eye of the beholder, if you will, as to who was getting victimized or who was a victim of discrimination.
So we want to look at the NIFLA ruling from these competing perspectives, and we talk with two different organizations, both representing Christian Americans. One of my guests sees this ruling as a win for religious liberty and an affirmation of a larger theology.
We actually don't look at this issue as a narrow issue. I mean, our beliefs about abortion, our beliefs about end-of-life issues, our beliefs about immigrants to some extent, flow from a conviction that every human being is made in the image of God and therefore deserves to be protected and honored and conferred with that level of dignity. So for us, this theology of human dignity has many different implications, of which our opposition to abortion is one. My name is Travis Wusso. I serve as the Vice President of Public Policy and General Counsel for the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission and lead our government affairs work here in D.C.
My other guest sees it as a loss for women's autonomy and as a wake-up call.
We seek to lift up the majority of the faithful who believe in the primacy of individual conscience, who believe in a healthy separation of church and state. We need the faithful in America who believe in a woman's right to make her own moral decisions over her body and to make responsible decisions about when to plan a family. We believe that those majority faithful voices need to be heard now more than ever. I am Cynthia Romero, and I'm the Director of Communications at Catholics for Choice.
We'll get back to Cynthia Romero in a bit. But first, let's start with my conversation with Travis Wusso. I asked him what, from the perspective of his organization, was the issue with the California law.
What's at issue, you know, are difficult questions of complicity from a moral and ethical framework. You know, I think what's important to understand is really two things. The first is that these centers exist because and they're founded by and run by individuals who possess a religious or moral opposition to abortion. That's the whole reason why they exist. And what they're trying to do is to provide resources and information and care for women who are seeking other options than abortion. You know, one of the premises of this FACT Act, these pro-life centers are misleading people, and that women walk in and, you know, wanting to get an abortion, and in fact, they find out, oh, well, they get religion jammed down their throats or something like that. You know, we're not aware of, and the petitioners in all of the cases that we've been tracking, you know, in no place has a state or city been able to produce a single instance where a woman was misled walking into one of these pro-life centers. You know, if you look at the way that they're marketed, you look at just their signage, it's pretty obvious what these things are. And so going back to the question of complicity, you know, the question at the heart of this case is, if you have an organization that is founded because they're trying to provide an alternative to something that they perceive to be a great moral, that they really deeply believe to be a great moral wrong, to then ask them to, in effect, provide referrals to that very moral wrong that they were founded to provide alternatives for, we think is wrong. It's an overreach of the government, and ultimately five justices of the Supreme Court agreed with that position.
I want to explore the religious liberty question here. How is this a victory for religious liberty in your organization's perspective?
I think what we have to recognize is that freedom of speech, freedom of expression, these protect all different kinds of messages, including religious messages. And I think, you know, it's worth noting that Justice Kennedy echoed this point in his concurring opinion. He wrote, "Governments must not be allowed to force persons to express a message contrary to their deepest convictions. Freedom of speech secures freedom of thought and belief, and this law imperils those liberties." So I think, you know, from our standpoint, there is a close connection between freedom of religion and freedom of expression.
And so the victory for religious liberty then is essentially an extension of the free speech of the an individual who's working in one of these clinics to not have to share or answer a question that an individual coming in would ask for, what are my options or what are the additional services they have available to them.
The FACT Act actually goes much further than any other ordinance like this, and what they require is for these pro-life centers to, in effect, refer for abortion, whether or not they get asked a question about what their options are or where an abortion clinic is or so on. I imagine that, you know, every pro-life center has a way of dealing with that situation or answering that question in a manner that's consistent with their own beliefs about complicity and so on. So our objection to this really is with the government stepping into those conversations and into those relationships and saying, even if you the very existence of your organization is centered around opposition to this, you know, to this procedure. They believe that it's a great moral wrong. The government is nonetheless requiring them to disseminate information about it.
But just to be clear, though, the decision was an affirmation of speech, not of establishment or free exercise.
No, that's definitely correct. I mean, this was a free speech case that, you know, but again, I mean, I think, you know, freedom of speech, the same is true of freedom of assembly. You know, these rights protect all kinds of institutions as well as religious institutions and all kinds of speech and beliefs as well as, you know, including religious speech and beliefs.
Is there a limit or an issue that you see between the religious conscience or the good faith disagreements that Justice Thomas referred to and the public health or the other interests that an individual or a citizen might have?
Well, that's, you know, that what you're hitting on is one of the justifications that the state of California used in passing the FACT Act. You know, one of the arguments that they said was that this law was needed in order to disseminate information about the availability of abortion services all around the state of California. Our point is, if the state of California wants to run an advertising campaign that informs its citizens about the availability of those services, well, pass a law and do it. But what's at issue in this case is forcing individuals who oppose this, who believe that abortion is a great moral wrong, to be the carriers of that message. So I guess the point is, you know, the point about your the point that you're making about informing the public about public health issues, you know, that's not really what this case is about. What this case is about is who is required to be the advertiser of that particular message. And the purpose of this law was to target these pregnancy resource centers. It wasn't this larger concern about making sure that the public is well informed about who is and who is not licensed and regulated. That's not what this law was about.
Do you think that crisis centers have fundamentally different obligations than doctors when they're serving their visitors?
As people of faith, Southern Baptists are dedicated to loving our neighbors as Christ loved us. And this is why, you know, so many in our churches serve women and children through pregnancy resource centers, trying to provide an alternative to compassionate care, an alternative to abortion to anybody who would walk into those doors. And so, you know, in that sense, yes, I do think that it's a fundamentally different enterprise, and the range of services that are being provided are different. You know, our primary hope for this case is that it will provide us with a tool to make sure that pro-life pregnancy resource centers have the ability to operate in a manner that's consistent with their beliefs and free from government harassment and interference.
That was Travis Wousseau from the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. Next, I spoke to Cynthia Romero from Catholics for Choice. She says that in the view of her organization, which represents Catholics who support reproductive rights, this decision is part of a larger, concerning trend.
There's a series of tendencies we've seen within recent court decisions and within sort of the political space to pit religion against choice. And we believe very firmly that now more than ever, it is important that we speak up for the majority of the faithful who believe in a woman's right to choice, and that these issues should not be pitted one against the other. We should ask ourselves as people of faith, is this moral? Is it morally right to deny women the information they need to make their own informed decisions, moral decisions that only they can make and that only they should be making between them and their doctor?
Aren't most women aware of the options to them already?
No, we're really, really concerned with the proliferation of these fake health centers that actively deceive women and that actively are situated in places especially where there are low-income communities that may speak English as a second language. They will do things like, for instance, we have a partner in Connecticut, an abortion clinic, where a fake health center set up shop with the exact same name right next door. And we'll have staff standing outside of the front door, luring in patients that are actually looking for the Hartford OBGYN Center that provides comprehensive reproductive care, but instead end up walking into this other Hartford center that has almost the exact same name and where they won't be provided comprehensive information about their options. And we have seen how our partners in Colorado have had a whole campaign illustrating how many billboards there are in low-income communities where these fake health centers specifically put up huge billboards advertising ultrasound screenings and other fake services that are actually meant to lure patients into their facilities. These centers are really difficult to tell apart from a legitimate center that provides comprehensive reproductive care.
You're describing them as fake health centers. Why are you calling them fake health centers?
Because they don't have trained staff providing comprehensive medical information to the women. They oftentimes will impose their religious beliefs on the women walking through the door, irrespective of whether that woman shares those religious beliefs. And they actively provide false and misleading information to the women, including telling them that, you know, abortion can cause all sorts of medical problems, using scare tactics to deceive these women and lead them to a predetermined outcome.
And are these clinics or are these centers associated with a particular religious tradition?
Not always, but some are. And some of these centers are getting funding from the Knights of Columbus and other ultra-conservative Catholic organizations. We're very concerned about that because those organizations do not speak for the majority of Catholics who would be appalled by this tendency, who would rather see our church spending its funds helping women to receive other services and to help women who already have children and need assistance.
Well, let me pick up on this for a second. You wrote in a recent Washington Post letter to the editor that it is possible to, quote, respect the faithful while respecting choice. Now, I saw that, but I'm also well aware that on the other side of this debate, there are many, many, many anti-abortion groups that are actually invoking faith as justification for this ruling, and that they view having to give the full information about abortion services, that that is a violation of their faithful disagreements, as Clarence Thomas put it in his writing. What do you make of that argument?
So, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I was specifically looking back at the ruling. And one of the things that I found incredibly ironic was that Justice Kennedy said this law is a paradigmatic example of the serious threat presented when government seeks to impose its own message in the place of individual speech, thought, and expression. I thought that was really ironic because we really work at Catholics for Choice on reminding faithful Americans, and especially Catholics, that we believe in women's individual conscience, that our church teaches that women should be trusted to make their own moral, ethical decisions, that they have their own individual speech, thought, and expression. And so I find it very ironic that in some of these cases, we've continued to say, well, what we're trying to do is respect the faithful. What about the faithful who are pro-choice? What about that woman who has every capacity to make her own decisions about when, whether, and how to have a family? And she should be empowered with the information to make an informed moral decision.
What do you make of that, that we're pitting two different points of view and under the same umbrella?
Religious freedom is about freedom of and freedom from religion. It's about your rights ending, you know, at your nose, right? And your rights end where the rights of others begin. And so you absolutely have a right to individually, consciously object. But that decision cannot infringe the rights of a woman seeking the care and seeking the information that she also deserves. The current climate of protecting religious freedom is actually an effort to redefine religious freedom as privileging one set of ultra-conservative Christian beliefs above the rights of all other faithful Americans and non-faithful Americans. Receiving comprehensive care is a human right. Roe v. Wade is still the law of the land. Every woman should have access to comprehensive reproductive care, including abortion, irrespective of how much money she makes, what insurance she has, what her faith is, or what the beliefs of those she encounters are.
I have to ask you, how do Catholics like those in Catholics for Choice reconcile this institutional position with your position on abortion rights?
Yeah, so we believe strongly that the hierarchy, the Catholic hierarchy, does not speak for the majority of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church are its people. The 300 members of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops do not speak for the majority of Catholic Americans. The majority, over 60% of American Catholics, believe that abortion can be a moral decision, believe that it should be legal. And we have seen Catholics the world over reaffirming this in overwhelming numbers. We just saw Ireland, staunchly Catholic country, over 80% Catholic still, and they overwhelmingly voted to repeal the Eighth Amendment and to legalize abortion. A year prior to that, we saw a similar decision in Chile, and now we see Argentina debating legalizing abortion in their country. So I think Catholics the world over reinforcing that they are pro-choice. And why? Because they respect the separation of church and state, and because individual conscience is the foundational tenet of our religion. From Thomas Aquinas on, there have been theologians that have argued strongly the case that well-informed conscience, if it leads you to a decision, even a decision that is at odds with the Catholic hierarchy, a Catholic should follow their conscience when making a decision. And that was debated a lot in Ireland over this past year, and they resoundingly showed that they believe that women should be trusted to make informed, conscientious decisions on their own without interference from the state or the hierarchy.
That was Cynthia Romero from Catholics for Choice. So, after this decision, what will happen the next time that abortion access and religious freedom intersect? Well, with swing vote Justice Anthony Kennedy retiring and Trump nominee Judge Brett Kavanaugh potentially replacing him, there are still many questions left on the table. We'll talk about that next. This is Interfaith Voices. We'll be right back.